welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, February 16th. I'm your reader, Kathleen. On the front page, the article this morning is Eastern Iowa Shivers, that accompanied by a photo of a bald eagle flying over the Cedar River looking for fish just past the dam in downtown Cedar Rapids. Temperatures around Cedar Rapids and Iowa City are expected to not crack freezing until at least Sunday. This article is by the Gazette staff. As parts of the corridor endured their fourth day in a row of high temperatures at or below zero, the state's largest utilities asked customers Monday to reduce their use of natural gas because of the added strain. A cold weather system for days has plunged temperatures across a wide swath of the nation to below freezing. Some 50 million Americans are expected to experience temperatures that are below zero. Even though the National Weather Service ended a weekend wind chill warning for much of eastern Iowa, temperatures still are forecast to be quite cold. Temperatures around Cedar Rapids and Iowa City are not expected to crack freezing. That's 32 degrees above zero until at least Sunday. If that forecast holds, it means Cedar Rapids and nearby communities will have gone 16 consecutive days this month with highs at freezing or below, according to the Weather Service. Alliant Energy and MidAmerican Energy were encouraging customers to reduce their natural gas use during the extreme cold, citing the spiking demand. Both utilities recommended making sure windows are sealed and making sure snow and ice are not blocking intake and exhaust pipes. Customers also should not use ovens or outdoor grills to heat their home. Alliant and MidAmerican advised customers to open curtains or blinds during the day to allow sunlight to come in, but to close them at night to fight cold air leaks. Other recommendations included turning down thermostats overnight or when the customer is gone, testing carbon monoxide detectors, and limiting the use of space heaters. If you're one of the many dealing with frozen water pipes in your home, your first call should be to a professional, advised Jim Street, owner of Street's Maintenance in Iowa City. First of all, if your pipes are frozen, chances are other people are calling a plumber to deal with that too, he said. When one plumber is busy, normally they all are, he said. The second reason is that trying to thaw a frozen pipe on your own can be ineffective at the least and dangerous at the worst, Street said. Depending on the area you are trying to thaw out, a heating element like a hairdryer might not get the job done. Other sources of heat could potentially melt insulation and start a fire. I try to steer people away from that stuff, Street said. Sometimes it takes a turn for the worse. Street said frozen pipes are most prevalent in mobile homes where heat tape on the water line can fail for various reasons. Street recommends checking that heat tape from time to time to make sure it's working. For all homes, Street recommends sealing up drafty areas. If you think a cold weather kit for your car is an ice scraper and some jumper cables, think again. Depending on the severity of the storm and your location, it could be quite some time for help to arrive if you find yourself broken down by the side of the road. If you have to travel in the cold, plan your trip and check the latest weather reports to try to avoid storms, recommended Greg Bulow, spokesman for Cedar Rapids Public Safety. Carry a winter survival storm kit, including blankets or a sleeping bag, flashlight with extra batteries, a first aid kit, a knife, high-calorie, non-perishable food, extra clothing to keep dry, a large empty can and plastic cover with tissues and paper towels for sanitary purposes, a can, candles, and waterproof matches to melt snow for drinking water, a sack of sand or cat litter for traction, a shovel, windshield scraper and brush, toolkit, tow rope, battery jumper cables, a water container, and a compass and road map. Also, Bulow advised to keep your gas tank near full to avoid ice in the tank and fuel lines, and let someone else know your planned travel route and timetable. Officials also recommend an extra charging cable or battery for your cell phone. Also on the front page this morning, facing a suit, UI restores women's swimming. This story by Vanessa Miller. University of Iowa is fully reinstating its women's swimming and diving team after a federal judge in December found athletes had a fair chance of winning a lawsuit accusing the UI of violating Title IX, a failure aggravated by its earlier decision to drop the women's program to help save money. According to an announcement Monday from UI Athletics Director Gary Barta, the women's swimming and diving team, originally slated to be cut at the end of the year, quote, due to financial challenges created by the pandemic, end quote, will be reinstated as an NCAA and Big Ten conference program. The women's swimming lawsuit brought forward last September, combined with the recent court order mandating the continuation of the sport during the legal process, has created additional uncertainty that could last several months or even years, Barta said in a statement. We made the decision the right thing to do was to reinstate the women's swimming and diving program and remove any uncertainty moving forward for our current student athletes as well as high school swimmers considering attending the University of Iowa. The women's program was among four the university planned to cut at the beginning of this academic year, along with men's swimming and diving, men's gymnastics, and men's tennis. Every student athlete in all 24 sports at Iowa has experienced challenges and uncertainty since the pandemic began, Barta said. This has been especially true for the men and women in the four sports we announced would be discontinued after this season. Despite its decision to reverse cutting women's swimming and diving, Barta's message said, quote, the financial challenge remains significant and the decision to discontinue the three men's sports identified will remain in place, end quote. UI Athletics in August estimated its COVID-19 compelled deficit would reach $75 million, prompting administrators to develop a plan for budget cuts, salary reductions, position eliminations, and discontinuation of the four sports after this season. Those mitigation steps, plus some semblance of a fall football season, reduced the deficit to $50 million to $60 million. UI officials told the State Board of Regents its athletic program will be recovering from pandemic losses for years. Even as donors and supporters promised millions to restore the cut Olympic sports and inundated Regents with pleas to change the university's mind, UI administrators had refused, although they committed to honoring cut student-athlete scholarships if they chose to remain at Iowa and provide academic, medical, and mental health support as requested. Women's swimming and diving athletes in September sued the UI for discontinuing their program, accusing the university of being out of compliance with Title IX, the federal gender equity law, by failing to provide its female athletes athletic participation opportunities substantially proportionate to their representation in the student body. The numbers do not lie, U.S. District Court Judge Stephanie Rose wrote in a December order. Plaintiffs have demonstrated a fair chance that the University of Iowa does not presently provide its female students with intercollegiate athletic opportunities in substantial proportion to their enrollment, and is unlikely to do so after eliminating the women's swimming and diving team for the 2021-22 academic year. For schools found in violation of Title IX, federal authorities can take corrective action, such as redistributing scholarships, shifting spending, or revising policies. Schools that don't act risk losing federal money, although that step has never been used. Rose said injunctive relief is an extraordinary remedy that is not issued lightly, but found reason to believe the female athletes suing the campus could win the suit. In the UI Athletic statement Monday, Barta said the university continues to disagree with the claims made in the lawsuit and the subsequent preliminary injunction to keep the sport while the overall lawsuit proceeds. Quote, the Iowa Athletics Department is committed to gender equity and has a rich history in the success of its women's sports program. The university has been and is committed to continuing to be in compliance with Title IX, end quote, the UI statement said. Also on the front page, new university free speech issue in Iowa, course outlines. This story by Vanessa Miller. After ISU controversy, GOP lawmakers want scrutiny. Continuing fallout from an Iowa State University professor's instructions last fall, barring students from choosing project topics opposing same-sex marriage, abortion or the Black Lives Matter movement, state lawmakers Monday advanced a measure requiring Iowa's public universities publish all course outlines online. House Study Bill 199, which Representative Dustin Height, Republican, New Sharon, introduced, and a House Education Subcommittee passed, adds to a growing catalog of proposed legislation this session aimed at addressing Republican concerns over free speech suppression at Iowa's universities, particularly suppression of conservative voices. Lawmakers also have advanced a pair of widely debated bills to make Iowa the first state in the nation to ban tenure, and another requiring universities poll and report to the General Assembly the political affiliation of all its tens of thousands of employees. Additionally, a legislative oversight committee has exacted intense pressure on Iowa's three public universities following free speech incidents in the fall, including the course syllabus uproar at ISU, the rejection of an anti-abortion rights study group at the University of Northern Iowa, and concerns over the University of Iowa Dental College's handling of a conservative student's criticism. The bill advanced Monday would require the UI, ISU, and UNI to post online syllabuses for all undergraduate and graduate-level credit courses by the start of class. The syllabuses, according to the bill, would have to include a summary of course requirements, major assignments and tests, required or recommending reading, and a general description of the subject matter of any lecture or discussion. If the instructor makes substantive changes to a course, the syllabus shall be updated as soon as reasonably possible, according to the proposed legislation, and the syllabus must be available on the institution's internet site for at least 2 years following the initial posting. The bill doesn't explicitly say whether the universities would have to post the outlines on public-facing sites or whether the university-only sites would suffice. None of the three public universities currently require that instructors post a course syllabus online or to make them publicly available, although some do. ISU came under fire last August after assistant teaching professor Chloe Clark, who's been with the university since 2016, included in her English 250 syllabus a giant warning, and that's in all capitals, against intentional, quote, othering, end quote, like racism, sexism, or homophobia. Threatening possible dismissal of her students, Clark barred them from pursuing any topic, quote, that takes at its base that one side doesn't deserve the same basic human rights as you do. That is, no arguments against gay marriage, abortion, Black Lives Matter, etc., end quote. After Clark's syllabus captured widespread attention, particularly among conservative media and lawmakers, ISU issued a statement affirming its commitment to free expression and noting Clark's syllabus didn't comply with its policies or values. Clark was reprimanded, slapped with a letter in her permanent file, and advised to revise her syllabus, which happened August 17, the first day of the fall semester, as soon as this issue came to our attention, according to an ISU statement. Clark remains on the ISU faculty and is teaching several lectures this spring, including English 250, which covers written, oral, visual, and electronic composition. A syllabus for her spring classes, provided to the Gazette upon request, includes course and learning objectives, some required texts, grading criteria, university policies, including free expression, and conduct expectations. Quote, in this course, you will restrict your commentary on discussion boards to class-specific activities and discussions, will refrain from profane or offensive outbursts or from disruptions, and will not engage in behavior that is demeaning, threatening, or harmful to either yourself or class members, end quote. Although still an ISU employee, Clark's name no longer appears in the ISU directory. After discussing this with Clark, her contact information was removed from the directory as a safety measure, according to ISU spokesman Rob Schwiers. In November, ISU adopted a free expression syllabus statement required verbatim for all courses. Quote, students will not be penalized for the content or viewpoints of their speech as long as student expression in a class context is germane to the subject matter of the class and conveyed in an appropriate manner, end quote, according to the new statement Provost Jonathan Wickert announced. ISU said it didn't change its policy, but rather required more communication about campus expectations. Moving now to the Iowa Today page, this story by Gage Miskimen. Lynn seeks climate action input. Survey will be available on the county website until April 2nd. Lynn County announced Monday that it is seeking public input on climate change and action. A survey available on the county website is designed to understand how residents perceive climate change and how climate disasters such as the August derecho affect residents, according to a news release. The release said the survey seeks to find out what climate action Lynn County residents would like to see in the county. Climate action within Lynn County should be led by Lynn County residents, Sustainability Program Manager Tamara Marcus said. If we want to build more sustainable and resilient communities, it is essential that we hear about the needs and priorities of county residents and use this to inform county climate action and policy. The Lynn County Board of Supervisors hired Marcus as the county's first sustainability program manager in September to further Lynn County's commitment to environmental sustainability and resource protection. Marcus said climate action needs likely will vary across municipalities, and the survey is just one tool the county will be using to understand the needs. Another tool is community partner focus groups, the release said. They will be led by Mount Mercy sociology professor Thaddeus Atzman, with the groups helping determine the next steps for climate action in the county, the release said. Community partners and group participants include the NAACP, Lynn Clean Energy District, HACAP, Trees Forever, Iowa Renewable Energy Training Center at Prairie Woods, Feed Iowa First, Indian Creek Nature Center, United Way of East Central Iowa, Mid-American Energy, AmeriGas, Lynn County Planning and Development, Marion Alliance for Racial Equity, and the Cedar Rapids Solid Waste and Recycling Division, according to the release. The survey is available on Lynn County's website until April 2. Also on the Today page, this story by Gage Miskimen, Marion Uptown Market shifting to a new site. Construction projects necessitate the move, vendor applications now being accepted. As Iowans face freezing temperatures this week, the Marion Chamber of Commerce is planning for the warmer months ahead. The Uptown Marion Market, held in the summer and fall, now is accepting vendor applications. The Marion Chamber is preparing to hold a pandemic-safe market during a busy construction season. Tammy Schlamp, Marion Chamber Director of Member Services, said this year's market will follow COVID-19 health protocol similar to last year's events. The market was held last summer on 6th Avenue instead of at City Square Park to help with crowd flow. However, the event this year cannot be held at City Square Park or on 6th Avenue because of construction in Marion's uptown. In the summer, Marion's streetscape project will close portions of 7th Avenue. Construction is scheduled to turn the Marion Square Plaza strip mall into a new mixed-use development named Broad and Main, and the new Marion Library will be in the midst of construction. Schlamp said this year's market will be held in a city-owned parking lot at 8th Avenue and 12th Street. It'll open up some new opportunities. We're hoping to do some partnerships with local businesses, but we haven't worked those details out yet, she said. Last year, masks were required for all vendors and staff and strongly requested for attendees. It really went well, Schlamp said. We did have direction from the state, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Inspection and Appeals, and the Iowa State University Extension Office. They had protocols that provided guidance that included controlling entrances. She said at this point the plans are to move forward with the same protocols as last year. If we get new guidance, we will make adjustments, she said. The further we get through the summer, hopefully more people are vaccinated. Last summer, Governor Kim Reynolds allowed for farmers' markets to carry on during months when Iowa was seeing high COVID-19 spread. Reynolds permitted food and produce vendors to sell products, treating the markets like grocery stores when it came to regulations. Schlamp said the Marion Market had about half of the vendors last year that it normally does. As far as attendees, we saw a steady increase throughout the summer. Luckily, it's an outdoor event with open air, she said. The hope this year is to get closer to the normal. Last year's June market didn't allow for children. We want a family-friendly event this year. We missed having that, where you can come with the kids, she said. Last year was supposed to be the launch of the Power to Produce partnership with the ISU Extension Office, but it was canceled due to the pandemic. The program, which teaches kids about the importance of food and produce, is scheduled to take place this year. This year's Uptown Marion markets are June 12, July 10, August 14, and September 25. Interested vendors can apply at the Chamber's website. And also in the Iowa Today, Marion Development changes its name to Easttown Crossing. Move follows efforts to remove a Native American slur from the Linn County locations. This story also by Gage Miskeman. A large mixed-use development in East Marion, formerly known as Squaw Creek Crossing, has changed its name. The development, now known as Easttown Crossing, follows efforts to remove an ethnic and sexual slur toward Native American women from names of places in Linn County. Easttown Crossing, at the intersection Highways 13 and 30, is a 20-acre property already hosting a Quick Star, Poncheros, Jersey Mike's, and Pizza Ranch, as well as DuPaco Community Credit Union. The site will be home to other businesses in the future, as well as a hotel and apartments. The name change creates a welcoming environment to all in the area, according to a news release from Ridge Development, developer of the $15 million property. Easttown Crossing is a name that reflects belonging and stands as the eastern gateway to Marion, the release said. Those that are new to the area, along with existing residents, can now see Easttown Crossing as a symbol of Marion's welcoming and vibrant community. In September, the former Squaw Creek Park became Wanatee Park, named after a women's rights activist and Meskwaki language specialist from Tama County, Jean Adeline Morgan Wanatee. As for the creek itself, the Linn County Board of Supervisors has formally requested that the U.S. Geologic Survey's Board of Geographic Names rename it Wanatee Creek. Changing the name of a river or stream involves federal, state, and local jurisdictions. The name change for the creek in Linn County already has the support of the cities of Cedar Rapids and Marion and the Linn County Board of Supervisors. Various groups were involved in discussions about the name change for the park and the creek, including the Sac and Fox tribes of the Mississippi of Iowa, Meskwaki Nation. Ryan Schlater, community outreach specialist for the Linn County Conservation Board, told the Gazette on Monday that the Board of Geographic Names has confirmed receipt of the name change request. The Board of Supervisors were told it is about a six-month process and perhaps longer due to COVID-19, which we anticipated, Schlater said. In November, supervisors approved name changes for road names that contained the slur. Multiple roads were renamed to include Wanatee. Moving now to the Insight page, the editorial today is a reprint from Sunday's Washington Post, and the title, Trump's Guilt is Clear. The second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump accomplished much and left much still to accomplish. The House impeachment managers proved beyond doubt that Trump was guilty of a disgraceful dereliction of duty. That was the post-trial assessment of the Republican state Senate leader, the Republican Senate leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who said Trump waged a campaign of disinformation and rage in the weeks leading up to January 6, and then was practically and morally responsible for provoking the attack on the Capitol by his followers on that day. Trump inflamed a violent mob that sought to derail a peaceful transition of power and then refused to calm or call back his supporters as they assaulted police officers and threatened the lives of Vice President Mike Pence and many other officials. The trial established a vital record of history and persuaded a bipartisan majority of 57 senators to vote to convict Trump. Among them were seven Republicans whose commitment to principle should be saluted: Richard Burr of North Carolina, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and Patrick Toomey of Pennsylvania. As profiles encourage, they join Representative Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming, who risked her House leadership position to repudiate Trump's betrayals, and Representative Jamie Herrera Butler, Republican from Washington, who bore witness to Trump's abhorrent behavior on January 6th, even as other Republicans fell into line. McConnell, his assessment of Trump's misbehavior notwithstanding, joined with 42 other Republicans in voting to acquit. He said he does not believe the Constitution gives the Senate the power to try a former officer, a view we find implausible, but one that some scholars endorse. There is a way for McConnell to square this circle, immediately join in sponsoring a resolution of censure, though it would be a milder sanction than conviction by 2/3 of the Senate. There would be value in requiring every senator to go on the record with regard to Trump's repulsive and dangerous actions. Congress's duty does not end there, however. Trump's guilt is clear, but many questions about the events of January 6th remain unanswered. They should be investigated, not least because of the threat that Trump continues to pose. Congress should immediately impanel a committee or commission to conduct an investigation. Trump's unsuitability for any role in public life is indisputable, thanks in part to the masterful work of impeachment managers. But the full history remains to be uncovered. Again, that's a reprint from the editorial in the Washington Post. And there are three community letters today. First, this by Matt Brandt in Cedar Rapids, disappointed in Grassley's performance. I am very confused and disappointed by Senator Chuck Grassley attempting to justify his major positions over the past few years. We went from Merrick Garland, even though Barack Obama had 11 months left, the people must decide, to Amy Coney Barrett, of course we need to railroad this confirmation through ASAP, to a cherry-picked version of Donald Trump inciting the insurrection. He misbehaved but should not be impeached. In the end, the only logic Grassley uses is the modified golden rule. He with gold makes the rules. And that, again, is by Matt Brandt. Our second letter comes from Palmer Holden in Iowa City, Democrats blinded by hatred for Donald Trump. Chuck Schumer and the Democrats are living in an alternative universe. You lost. Quit whining. I should be amazed that 50 Democratic senators watched the defense team demonstrate how the Democrats manipulated the evidence, and not one had the courage to say not guilty. Of course, I'm not amazed. Their hatred of Trump blinded their common sense. That's by Palmer Holden. And our final letter, by Daryl Siverson in Strawberry Point, senators made excuses for Trump. The Republican Party is now the rationalization party. To avoid voting guilty, our two senators used the excuse that Donald Trump was no longer in office. Would they have used this logic if members of Congress had been killed by Trump's mob? Evidently, the destruction of our Capitol and the lives lost January 6th were not enough. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, February 16, on IRIS, and now we turn to today's obituaries. In other notices from Cedar Rapids, Joseph Davis, age 89, died Sunday, February 14, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. Also in Cedar Rapids, Slatko Hayden, age 74, died Monday, February 15, again, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. In Fayette, Arletta Shaler Vandersee, age 93, died Saturday, February 13. Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation, West Union. In Iowa City, Lori Fitzgerald, age 61, died Saturday, February 13th. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. And in Loudoun, Barbara J. Holst, age 77, died Saturday, February 13. The Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence is assisting the family. Moving now to the longer or regular notices, from Strawberry Point, Alvera Elizabeth Hogan passed away February 12th at Cottage Grove Place Gardens in Cedar Rapids. The Hogan family would like to extend their gratitude to all the staff at Cottage Grove Place Gardens. Memorials may be made in Alvera's name to the food pantry at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Strawberry Point. A private family service will be held February 27 with the Reverend John Haugen officiating. Final resting place will be the Cass Township Cemetery in Strawberry Point. Condolences may be sent to Janet Benning, 403 Crimson Drive Northeast, apartment 25 in Cedar Rapids. The Muller Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Cedar Rapids, Glenn Hall, age 79, passed away Friday, February 12. No services are being held. There will be a celebration of life at a later date. He is being cremated. There will be no visitation. Also in Cedar Rapids, Carol Jean Vanskoy Tepley, age 83, passed away February 9, with her loving husband by her side in Arlington, Washington. Weller Funeral Home at 327 North McLeod Avenue, Arlington, Washington, is in charge of the funeral arrangements. A private family service will be held at a later date. In Cedar Rapids, James, known as Jim P. Wubbins, age 56, formerly of Charles City, passed away February 13, surrounded by family at St. Luke's Hospital after battling COVID-19. Visitation will begin at 11:30 Wednesday, February 17, at the Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, February 17, at Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. The Reverend Andrew Marr will officiate. In Iowa City, Jack H. Beck, age 94, formerly of Skokie, Illinois, died Saturday, February 13, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. No public services are planned. Gay and Chia Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Iowa City, Donald Myron Ewalt, 75, of Licking, Missouri, formerly of Iowa City, died Friday, February 12. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 Friday, February 19, at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City, with Father Stephen Witt officiating. Friends may view the funeral service by way of a Zoom link located on Don's obituary page at www.lansingfuneral.com under the tribute wall. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 Thursday at the funeral home. Burial will be at St. Joseph's Cemetery. From Newton, Robert M. Upa, age 84, passed away at the Acura Health Care Center in Newton, surrounded by loving family. The family wishes to have an interment at the St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Chelsea, Iowa, at a later date. The Cedar Memorial Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Iowa City, Dennis Bradley, known as Brad Kesey or Kesey, passed away January 27, surrounded by family and supported by the thoughts and prayers of friends, family, and colleagues across the nation and the world. Because of COVID-19 restrictions, a private memorial service for the family will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 17, at the First United Methodist Church. However, the service will be live-streamed so many can celebrate his life. The Zoom link can be found under the tribute wall on his obituary page at lansingfuneral.com. From Marion, Clellan, known as Clell, Lewis Wilds, age 87, passed away from complications due to COVID-19, Sunday, February 14, surrounded by his daughter and little sister, Jerry. The funeral service will follow Thursday, February 18. Friends will be greeted from noon to 1 at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service. And again, the funeral service will follow at 1 o'clock on Thursday, conducted by Pastor John Albertson. Burial will take place at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. In Swisher, Jerome, known as Jerry Lee Wisnowski Sr., died on February 12. At age 77 in his home. Private family services will be held at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids with burial in DuPont Cemetery. The celebration of life will be from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. March 27 at JW's Pub and Grub, located at 58 Miller. In Monticello, Joseph Spar, age 80, died Thursday, February 11 at Jones Regional Medical Center following a sudden illness. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 10, at Peace United Church of Christ in Monticello, with interment in Oakland Cemetery. Friends may call from 4 to 7 Friday, April 9, at the Getch Funeral Home. You may access the live service by going to www.getchonline.com and then by clicking Watch Our Live Services on the Facebook button. That will direct you to Getch's Facebook page. You may also sign the guest book or leave condolences at the funeral home's website. In Mount Vernon, Joseph Cullen, age 91, died February 13 at Bickford Senior Living in Iowa City. Private family mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, February 20th at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church, Mount Vernon, by the Reverend Andrew Awatwi Mensah. Burial will be at Mount Vernon Cemetery. The Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Mount Vernon, is caring for Joe and his family. From Dakota Dunes, South Dakota, Gerald, known as Jerry Leroy Duhame, age 80, passed away Thursday, February 11, at Unity Point Hospital. Because of COVID-19, no services will be held at this time. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Cober Funeral Home of Elk Point, South Dakota, has been entrusted with services. And lastly, from Mechanicsville, Miriam Hennix, age 91, passed away Monday, February 15, at Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton. A graveside service at Rose Hill Cemetery in Mechanicsville will be held at a later date. Chapman Funeral Home has Marion and her family in their care. Memories and condolences may be shared at www.chapmanfh.com. Moving now to the sports page, girls basketball. This story by Jeff Linder. IGHSAU sets fan limit at state, 4,500 maximum per game spread out across the arena. It won't be a full house, but it won't be crickets either. Gene Berger, executive director of the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union, said Monday attendance will be capped at 4,500 for each game of the girls' state basketball tournament, which runs March 1 through 6th at Wells Fargo Arena. People are going to be spread out a lot more than usual, and masks will be mandated, Berger said. Capacity at Wells Fargo is 16,110. This might impact four or five of the sessions, Berger said. Last year's Class 5A championship game drew about 4,500. Berger said seating will be on a pod-reserved format in which people can purchase blocks of 2, 4, or 6, for example. All pods will be separated from each other, and that includes student sections. To accommodate the socially distanced crowd, seats will be pulled out in both end zones, and some of the seating will be in the upper deck. If we get close to 4,500, not all of that will be in the lower bowl, Berger said. Games will be 2 hours apart to allow sanitization between games. The Monday and Tuesday sessions will begin at 9 a.m., and the final game for both days will start at 9 p.m. Also in regional girls basketball, this story by Jeff Linder, streaking Blazers draw a tough opener. The Blazers don't enjoy much depth. Coach Chad Thomason's generally employs a rotation of 6 players. And yet they don't sit in a shell and rest on defense. Defense has been carrying us, Thomason said. We force a lot of steals and are able to get into a faster tempo game. Battle-tested in the WOMAC Conference and one of the hottest area Class 2A teams, Beckman, at 11-10, takes a 5-game winning streak into tonight's most intriguing area postseason game. The Blazers travel to 12th-ranked Cascade, 15-6, for a 2A regional quarterfinal. Tip-off is at 7 p.m. They've been playing pretty well, Cascade interim coach Ernie Billabaugh said of the Blazers. They've got a couple of really nice wins lately against Solon and Centerpoint Urbana. It's going to be tough. Beckman has collected more than 13 steals per game this season and swiped 23, 9 by Lauren Osterhaus, in a 45-9 first-round romp over South Winneshiek on Saturday. It was 41-2 at halftime. Our 3 guards, we don't sub unless they get in foul trouble, Thomason said. We rotate our 3 posts, and we use our timeouts for a rest if we get winded. The Cougars handled the Blazers 47-35 on December 19. We did a good job defensively, Billabaugh said. They didn't have a good shooting night, and we got some baskets in transition. We've got to control their shooters again, especially senior Kennedy Ahrens, who averages 15.3 points per game. They're a strong physical team, so we've got to rebound. the area's undisputed top three 2A teams hop into postseason action tonight. Number one, Maquoketa Valley at 20-0 hosts Starmont 4-18. Number three, West Branch, with a record of 17-1, welcomes Danville at 7-13. And number five, North Lynn, 18-2, entertains Hudson 11-11. North Lynn is the defending 2A state champion. In 1A, number six, Montezuma is the headliner for a Region 6 bracket that features four ranked squads. The Bravettes at 19-1 carry a 19-game win streak into their home contest with Iowa Valley at 13-8. Montezuma is pursuing its fourth consecutive state tournament. And number eight, Springville at 18-4 hosts Lisbon at 10-9. In boys basketball, Linmar is at Xavier today. Iowa City High is at Jefferson. Liberty's at Kennedy. Washington's at Iowa City West. Prairie is at Dubuque Senior. And Marion is at Benton-Shelsburg. In girls bowling, it's the state qualifying meets. Iowa City High, Iowa City West, Linmar, Prairie at 3A districts number 2 will take place at Colonial Lanes in Iowa City at 10. Jefferson at 3A District 3 will be at the Rose Bowl in Muscatine at noon. Kennedy, Washington at 3A District 5 at the Cadillac Lanes in Waterloo. And Marion and Xavier are at the 2A District 5 Cadillac Bowl in Waterloo at 10. Moving back to the Iowa Today page with some additional stories. This by the Associated Press out of Des Moines. The state alters decision to withhold vaccines. Some counties put on hiatus, get shots after all. Iowa health officials have modified a decision they made last week to withhold COVID-19 vaccines from some counties that were reported as not having used up to 80% of their allocation. The Iowa Department of Public Health informed five counties last week that it would withhold this week's allotment of vaccine because they had not inoculated enough people and needed time to catch up. The decision drew criticism from several county health administrators who said the state was either mistaken or that bad weather had temporarily slowed their progress. The announcement followed a new state rule requiring the use of at least 80% of a county's vaccination allotment. The rule is designed to reduce the number of vaccine doses sitting in storage. Monday, the state public health department said the counties would be getting their allotment of vaccines after negotiating an agreement to resolve the issue that led to lagging vaccine use, the Des Moines Register reported. Ty Burkhart, director of the Buchanan County Health Department, said her county had used at least 80% last week, but because one of its vaccination clinics was held on Friday, state officials who had used Thursday figures wrongly thought the county was behind. Washington County will get its 300 doses this week, although on Friday, later than usual. Washington County Public Health Director Danielle Pettit-Majewski said a blizzard forced a vaccination clinic to be rescheduled. Once that was counted, the county met the threshold. Pettit-Majewski said she has no concerns about not meeting the state's 80% burn rate threshold. We know we'll be getting our allocated doses and we'll be able to serve the community, she said. That's all we want to do. Iowa's current focus in its vaccination effort is on people 65 and older, teachers and child care workers, police and firefighters. Also in Iowa news, police seek a man in a store shooting. This out of Marshalltown, police in central Iowa are seeking a suspect in the shooting death Monday of a man working at a Marshalltown convenience store. The shooting happened just after 3 a.m. inside a Casey's convenience store on 3rd Avenue, according to a news release by Marshalltown police. Officers called to the store found a man suffering from a gunshot, who later died. He was identified as Michael Ray West, a 48-year-old Marshalltown resident who was working at the store. Police have not publicly identified a suspect, but do have surveillance video from the store showing a person in sunglasses and a black hooded jacket brandishing a gun as he walks through the store entrance. Here are the Eastern Iowa briefs for today. Northeast Iowa Foundation taking scholarship applications. The deadline to submit 2021 scholarship applications to the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa is March 10. The online application can be found on the Community Foundation's website at cfneia.org/scholarships. The foundation awarded nearly $588,000 in scholarships to high school, college, and adult students in 2020. A total of 272 scholarships were awarded to students pursuing higher education opportunities, with an average award of $2,165. Scholarship opportunities are available to students across the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa's 20-county region, which consists of 23 affiliate community foundations. Students interested in applying for 2021 scholarships should visit the website to view the eligibility checklist. Once it is determined a student is eligible for one or more scholarships, a common application, also available through the Community Foundation website, must be completed. The common application requires basic student information, transcript of academic record, summary of extracurricular experiences, an essay portion, and a letter of recommendation. All required materials must be submitted through the online system. Students must visit the Community Foundation's website for instructions and to begin the application process. For more information about scholarship opportunities, contact Tamika Fisher, Scholarship and Grant Manager, at 319-243-1359. And in Cedar Rapids, a drive-through food box giveaway is Saturday. Together We Achieve will be sponsoring its 12K in 2021 program, where 12,000 food boxes will be distributed throughout the community in 2021. The February drive-through food box giveaway event number one is scheduled for Saturday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Organizers are asking for volunteers to place food boxes into vehicles and help with traffic control, and for volunteers with trucks to help haul pallets and crates, all during the Saturday event from 9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Volunteers can sign up by going to signupgenius.com. Then there's a whole bunch of letters. So let me give you a phone number here. Call 319-432-9754 to volunteer. Those coming for the food giveaway are asked to stay in their car and wear face masks as vehicle doors and windows are open. Volunteers also will be required to wear masks as well as practice social distancing. Cash or check donations will be accepted at the site, or they can be mailed to 1150 27th Avenue Southeast, Cedar Rapids, 52404. And in Linn County, NAMI offering free online class to help with mental health. As the COVID-19 pandemic and the aftermath of the August 10 derecho continue to disrupt daily routines, mental health rates have risen. This has overwhelmed mental health facilities and providers, and families increasingly deal with loved ones who suffer depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, and rising levels of substance abuse. To help family members of adults with serious mental health issues, NAMI, Linn County, will offer a free online class, NAMI Family to Family, at 6 p.m. Monday nights for 8 weeks, beginning March 8. Resources, exercises, and content will help family members develop understanding, confidence, and stamina to provide support. Trained teachers offer live experience in dealing with serious mental health issues in a loved one. Advance registration is required by February 28. Send your name and address to nami-lc@hotmail.com or call 319-221-1184. And in Johnson County, the county is to host a February 25 Behind the Beat event. The Johnson County Diversity and Inclusion Committee will host a virtual event, Behind the Beat, with the African American Museum of Iowa from 1 to 2 p.m. February 25 via Zoom. The event is open to the public and there is no fee to attend. Live captioning will be provided. Explore African American history through music with the African American Museum of Iowa. From African beats to the jazz of the Harlem Renaissance, to the popular music of the civil rights movement. Each musical style has ties to history. Find out how traditional African music influenced jazz, R&B, rock and roll, hip-hop, and other forms of modern music. Registration for the event is available. If you require accessibility measures to be taken in order for you to comfortably participate in this Zoom event, contact the Johnson County Diversity and Inclusion Committee. And the top weather story today, not quite a record streak of cold. It has been very cold in Cedar Rapids over the last several days. We fell off a cliff temperature-wise on February 4. The last time we saw a temperature in the double digits above zero was February 5 at a balmy 11 degrees. However, it appears we will fall short of a record stretch for cold daytime highs. The last 3 days stayed below zero in the afternoon. However, there have been streaks 4 days long, the most recent being during another brutal cold snap between January 31 and February 3 in 1996. Whether we approach the all-time streaks of lows below zero, which is 17 days, is an open question. Right now, we're at 11 straight days. Stay tuned, and that's from meteorologist Corey Thompson. Cedar Rapids today is looking for a high of 5 degrees and a low tonight of 12 below. Iowa City, a high of 6 and a low of 11 below. Our normal high today is 36 and a low of 18. The record high set in 1921 was 67. The record low in 1905 was at minus 21. Our sunset tonight is at 5:41 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 7. Today's daylight hours are 10 hours and 40 minutes. And we are in a waxing crescent moon phase with moon rise at 9:35 a.m. and moon set at 10:46. That does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Zofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once-weekly or twice-monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.